All right, so this morning we are talking about I Am the Good Shepherd, which is certainly something that we've heard a lot. What I'm going to do is jump into John 10, and I did not put a slide up for the beginning part of John 10 from 1 through 10, but I do have from 11 on. And so I'm going to go ahead and read, and then when I get to verse 11, I'll put it on the screen. So if you want to follow along in your Bible, or if you want to wait for the slide to catch up, either one, feel free to do what you would like. Very truly, I tell you, Pharisees, anyone who does not enter the sheep pen by the gate, but climbs in by some other way, is a thief and a robber. The one who enters by the gate is the shepherd of the sheep. The gatekeeper opens the gate for him, and the sheep listens to his voice. He calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. When he has brought out all his own, he goes ahead of them, and his sheep follow him because they know his voice. But they will never follow a stranger. In fact, they will run away from him because they do not recognize the stranger's voice. Jesus used this figure of speech, but the Pharisees did not understand what he was telling them. Therefore, Jesus said again, "Very truly I tell you, I am the gate for the sheep. All who have come before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep have not listened to them. I am the gate. Whoever enters through me will be saved. They will come in and go out and find pasture. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I have come that they may have life and have it to the full. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. The hired hand is not the shepherd and does not own the sheep. So when he sees the wolf coming, So when he sees the wolf coming, he abandons the sheep and runs away. Then the wolf attacks the flock and scatters it. The man runs away because he is a hired hand and cares nothing for the sheep. I am the good shepherd. I know my sheep, and my sheep know me. Just as the Father knows me, and I know the Father, and I lay down my life for the sheep. I have other sheep that are not of this sheep pen. I must bring them also. They too will listen to my voice, and there shall be one flock and one shepherd. The reason my Father loves me is that I lay down my life only to take it up again. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down on my own accord, and I have the authority to lay it down and the authority to take it up again. This command I have received from my Father." Father God, thank you for this morning. Thank you for your word. Thank you for our many, many blessings. Lord, I ask as we come in and we study your word this morning that your grace shower down on us, that we feel your love and that your spirit move among us. I ask these things in your son's name. So as we've gone through these I am statements over the last several weeks in John, we have followed Jesus as he's gone through and claimed to be the fulfillment of the prophecies. And where we pick up today in John chapter 10, verse number 11, is just a continuation of that conversation. So his crowd had many there that were prophets, that were Pharisees, that were his disciples were in the crowd, and many of the crowd was Jewish. And so as he goes in and he starts talking about shepherding, that is something that they knew not only in a real sense, in a literal sense of their agrarian lives, but also in their religion. The Jews knew all about bad shepherds. The Old Testament prophets constantly criticized the rulers of Israel for being bad shepherds who were more interested in feeding and caring for themselves than God's people. Jesus was hitting at the heart of the Pharisees when he claims to be the good shepherd. I've got four references to the Old Testament. I didn't put them out here in, I will read them, but I did put them out here. Hey, I should have read all the way to 21. We're going to start with Jeremiah chapter 23, 1 through 4. Jesus, it is written, "Woe to the shepherds who are destroying and scattering the sheep of my pasture, declares the Lord. Therefore, this is what the Lord of God, Lord, the God of Israel, says to the shepherds who tend my people. Because you have scattered my flock and driven them away and have not bestowed care on them, I will bestow punishment on you for the evil you have done, declares the Lord. I myself will gather the remnant of my flock out of all of the countries where I have driven them and will bring them back to pasture. where they will be fruitful and increase in number. I will place shepherds over them who will tend them, and they will no longer be afraid or terrified, nor will any be missing, declares the Lord. So that starts off with the statement, woe to the shepherds. Further on in Jeremiah chapter 25, verses 34 through 38, weep and wail, you shepherds, roll in the dust, you leaders of the flock, for your time to be slaughtered has come. You will fall like the beast of the rams. The shepherds will have nowhere to flee, the leaders of the flock no place to escape. Hear the cry of the shepherds, the wailing of the leaders of the flock, for the Lord is destroying your pasture. The peaceful meadows will be laid waste because of the fierce anger of the Lord. Like a lion, he will leave his lair, and their land will become desolate because of the sword of the oppressor and because of the Lord's fierce anger. That one starts out with, weep and wail, you shepherds. Next is Isaiah chapter 56, verse 9 through 12. Come, all you beasts of the field, come and devour all you beasts of the forest. Israel's watchmen are blind. They all lack knowledge. They are all mute dogs. They cannot bark. They lie around and dream. They love to sleep. They are dogs with mighty appetites. They never have enough. They are shepherds who lack understanding. They all turn to their own way. They seek their own game. Come, each one cries, let me get wine. Let us drink our fill of beer, and tomorrow will be like today, or even far better. In Isaiah, there's statements like, Israel's watchmen are blind. They're all mute dogs. They're shepherds who lack understanding. And then Ezekiel, the entire 34th chapter of Ezekiel is really a condemnation on the shepherds of Israel. I'm just going to read the first six verses. The word of the Lord came to me, son of man, prophesy against the shepherd of Israel. Prophesy and say to them, this is what the sovereign Lord says. Woe to the shepherds of Israel, who only take care of yourselves. Should not shepherds take care of the flock? You eat the curds and clothe yourselves with wool and slaughter the choice animals, but you do not take care of the flock. You have not strengthened the weak or healed the sick or bound up the injured. You have not brought back the strays or searched for the lost. You have ruled them harshly and brutally. So they were scattered because there's no shepherd, and when they were scattered, they became food for the wild animals. My sheep wandered over all the mountains on every high hill. They were scattered over the whole earth, and no one searched or looked for them. There is no doubt when Jesus says that he is the good shepherd, that everyone in the crowd understood the reference. What they longed for, what the people longed for, was the messianic shepherd who would make God's love present. In their minds was the prophecy of Isaiah. It starts out, see, the Lord comes. Then verse 11 says, he will feed his flock like a shepherd. He will gather the lambs in his arms and carry them in his bosom and gently lead those with young. When Jesus said, I am the good shepherd, they knew that he was claiming to be the Messiah, to be making God present. He was saying things are going to change. They knew what shepherds did. I'm going to look at three aspects this morning of Jesus as the shepherd or a good shepherd. And we begin with Jesus saying, I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. The first thing we'll look at is he gives his life as a sacrifice for them. My family and I are on an experiment to be owners of livestock. Now, it's taught me some things, but as I was preparing and I was thinking about all of the sacrifice that I do for the ducks, I really didn't have to look that far, because I thought about times when maybe I've been in a grocery store or a gas station, and all of a sudden there's a verbal confrontation, and you can sense trouble coming, and the first reaction is to grab my children and put them behind me, to physically insert myself between the threat and my children. That is very similar to what we see here in Jesus' sacrifice. In the world of ducks, we have educated ourselves through video, and we watch a gentleman who lives in Canada who is raising, at this point in time, he's got about 900 ducks, and he lives on the edge of a lake, and he has a predator problem sometimes. And what he did recently was, between the lake and his flock, there is a swamp area that is covered with really high grass. This grass grows incredibly high. And so he spent 50-some-odd hours cutting this down. And what he was saying was that by cutting down this grass, the predators aren't brave enough to get through to the flock because they have to go through open ground. And so with me, that really struck a chord, because Jesus has already made the sacrifice. I've already been saved. I have no fear of death. So where do I fit into this section? And I thought, well, the grass is like the world, right? And the predator can sneak up and he can attack me, but the Bible is my weed eater. And I'm able to clear out the grass, and I'm able to really make a lot of room that I can see things coming at me. And so when I'm in the Word and I'm spending good time with Jesus, I've cleared my grass, and I can see the threats coming at me from a long, long, long away. But when I'm not in the Word and that grass starts to grow, I start to get really vulnerable, and the predator can get really close to me. And kids have got an amazing perspective on things. And Lauren and I had a conversation yesterday about music, and she sits up. And we have this conversation. I'm listening. So AC/DC Hell's Bells comes on the radio. And she said, "Dad, did you listen to this kind of music when you were young?" I said, "You know, I didn't. You know, I listen to it now, but I didn't listen to it then. I didn't listen to a lot of hard rock." And Lauren says, "Dad, that's not hard rock." Well, for a kid in 1980, it was hard rock, you know. And so I said, "You know, I was fortunate. My father was a musician. My mother was a fan of my musician father, and so she was a child of the 60s, so she went through a lot of the demonization of the music that she was listening to, so I think that she was really pretty forgiving on the music I listened to." And Lauren said this, she said, "It's ridiculous that people think that the devil is in hard rock, because that's obvious. What you need to, if the devil is coming at you through music, don't you think that he would come in the sweetest music that you could hear? Don't you think that he would put himself in a position to be so desirable that you would want to go after him and not other things?" And man, out of the mouths of children comes some wisdom that was unexpected. So as I think about the aspect of the Good Shepherd and the sacrifice and Jesus putting himself between me and the dangers of the world, and how I, as a father, put myself, or I, as the keeper of ducks, put myself between the dangers of the world and it, that seems obvious. The nugget that I got out of that is that I need to clear the grass so I can see the predator coming. All right. So the next thing is, a good shepherd shows sympathy for his flock. This section of John's Gospel we're studying begins with Jesus saying that the Good Shepherd gives his life for his sheep, but most of what follows speaks of the Good Shepherd's care and sympathy for the sheep. Bad shepherds here are spoken of hirelings. They do not care for the sheep. If a wolf comes, they will run away. In contrast, the Good Shepherd knows each one of his sheep, and they know him. In the wonderful assuring words, Jesus says, "The sheep hear my voice. I know them, and they follow me. I give them eternal life, and they will never perish. No one will snatch them out of my hand." Note the personal pronouns in the passage. The Good Shepherd says, "I know my sheep, and the sheep know my voice. I came that they may have life. I lay down my life for them." I don't know if I put, "they follow me," and the last one I didn't have room for, "but no one will snatch them out of my hand." The bond of love between the Good Shepherd and his flock is profound, personal, and strong. In verse 15, it's paralleled to the bond between Jesus and the Father. "I know my sheep just as the Father knows me, and I know the Father. There are times when I don't think that anybody understands what I'm going through. And to read that Jesus knows me like he knows his Father, and the knowledge that I have of how Jesus and the Father's relationship is inseparable, is intimate. One commentary talked about the use of know, you know, like knowledge here, and it's a very intimate translation. It got into like Adam knew Eve, and they had children. And so it's a very intimate knowledge that they're talking about here. And one of the most frustrating things in the world for Jennifer to tell me is that she knows me better than I know myself. I'm offended when she says that, but she's absolutely right, because she sees what I do, and what I do a lot of times reveals more than what I think. I do things that become very predictable. I may say that I want to do something. I may say that I'm not going to forget to take out the trash again. I may say that I'm going to whatever it is, but she knows me. That knowledge comes through time together, through intimate time together. It's a lot like watching our children make mistakes and knowing and being able to see those things. And so it's very comforting to me to hear Jesus say that he knows me, that he knows my mistakes are inevitable sometimes, that he knows that my love for him, while sometimes not expressed, is always present. It is very wonderful to hear that there is that knowledge, there is that sympathy. I think that we can all relate to the feeling of sympathy when we watch somebody that we love go through something that we can see coming 100 miles away and they can't see it yet. I know, as a parent of teenagers, I spend I feel like I'm in a constant state of sympathy for their decision making sometimes. The last thing, I don't know why my bullets are all twisted up. All right, so the last thing is the shepherd's search for lost sheep. John chapter 10 begins with the shepherd calling out his flock in verse 3. What is envisaged is more than one flock in a sheepfold for the night. Okay, so if you imagine the fold in the neighborhood, in the village, all of the flocks would go in, and they would all be there. And the ability for the shepherd to come in there, and one commentary say he would call them by name. Another one said that sometimes they would play a flute. But if you think about, you know, pick a number. There's 60 sheep in there, and the shepherd comes up, and he's able to, just by his voice, call out his and only his to him. So when it says that the shepherd is calling out his flock and the knowledge that the flock has of his voice, but then it goes on and it says, I have other sheep that do not belong to this fold. I must bring them along and they will listen to my voice. So there will be one flock and one shepherd. If you look in a commentary, you'll see that the calling out of the sheep alludes to Jesus calling out the believers of the house of Israel. That's the original flock. The other sheep he wants in the flock are the Gentiles, who the apostles will go after his death and resurrection. Today, they are you and me. His vision of a new people of God, the church made up of Jew and Gentile as one flock and one shepherd. I listened to a podcast not too long ago by the name of a gentleman of Malcolm Gladwell. He's done a lot of books, really good stuff. I recommend you listen to it. He was talking about education and the gifts, the monetary gifts that education are given. And I learned that Princeton University's, there's a term for the money that they have there. It was $11 billion, B with a B, billion, $11 billion endowment, that's what it is. When the current president of Princeton took over, and now the current president of Princeton is starting to is getting ready to leave, and that endowment is at $22 billion. And there was recently a gift from the founder of Nike of, $400 or $500 million. And the question that Malcolm Gladwell put forth is, how much money does that university need? Like, how much money do you need? It really offends him that $500 million was given to Princeton, who had $22 billion. And the reason why this gift was given was because the president of Princeton wanted to set up something similar to a Rhodes College or a Rhodes Scholar. And so what they wanted to do every year was take 100 of the brightest students of the entire, the brightest graduating seniors, and instill the scholarship program where they would spend the next 2 years working on some of the greatest problems of the world. And he figures those 100 students are going to need somewhere in the neighborhood of about $125 million a year. So I don't know what that, how that works. But the question, so Malcolm Gladwell countered that with a gentleman who owned a steel company and gave $125 million to a very small university as a gift. The scholarship guy came to him asking him for $1,500. And so he gave, or $15,000, so he gave him $15,000. So inevitably, like scholarship people do, or fundraising people do, after you give them once, they come back again. And so he comes back the second time, and he starts asking him about maybe contributing $125,000. And this gentleman says, well, what could you do with $125 million? And so this was a small, not community college, but a small city college. And it really changed the way that this university could service the students. That's a long way to get to this theory. What Malcolm Gladwell put forth was the Princeton and the founder of Nike went with the strong link theory. They were putting all of their money into a very small group of people that they felt could make a big difference. And the gentleman who donated $125 million to a small city college went with the weak link theory, and that his $125 million would help a lot of people do a lot of things. And it was a fundamental, he put out the example of, it's proven, economists have proven that a soccer club will win more games by improving their worst player than they will improving their first. Because in order to score a goal in soccer, there's typically 7 to 8 passes to the person that's going to make the goal that have to go right. And if your worst player misses up one of those passes, you lose your opportunity to score, as opposed to basketball, where you can have somebody like Michael Jordan, you can pay him $100 million, and that guy can score 60% of the points on your team by himself with needing very little help. How in the world does all of that apply to what Jeremy's talking about today? This is what struck me. Am I spending my time in my personal ministry in a strong link or a weak link mentality? Am I spending my time talking to like-minded people who are already saved and trying to make a difference in Christ's world in a very easy place? Am I investing that time in strong link, or am I investing that time with the people that aren't saved and where my hour a week will go much further in conversation and fellowship and relationship than it would over here? And I know my answer. And my answer is I spend almost all of my time with strong links. It's comfortable for me. But we were called by the Good Shepherd to be a little bit more weak-link-minded. Weak-link-minded. In Luke 15, Jesus talks about the search for his sheep. It's one of the things that he was critical of. He talks about losing the one, right? And he's sitting down and he's eating with sinners and taxpayers, and they say to him, why are you spending your time here? And he says to those that challenged him, if there is one astray, would you not leave the 99 to go find him? And that the hosts of heaven will celebrate at the salvation of one. I need to spend more time on weak links. I need to spend more time with the one and not be so worried about the strong links and the 99.